The damn thing was crammed with figures and details as it was, always room for one more. I was reaching out a brush loaded with what could have been blood to do just that when the phone rang. I almost let it go, surely would have done, if I'd been in one of my painting trances, but I wasn't. The picnic basket was only meant to be a grace note, and I had already added others. I put the brush back and picked up the phone. It was Wireman, and he sounded excited. "She had a clear patch this afternoon, Edgar. It might not mean anything. I'm trying to keep my hopes low, but I've seen this before. First one clear interval, then another, then another. Then they start to merge together and she's herself again, at least for a while." "She know who she is, where she is?" "Not now, but for half an hour or so, starting around 5:30. She knew that stuff and who I was, too. Listen, muchacho, she lit her own damn cigarette." "I'll be sure to tell the Surgeon General," I said. But I was thinking, 5:30, right around the time Jack and I had been waiting for the drawbridge. Around the time I'd felt that urge to draw. Did she want anything besides a cigarette? She asked for food, but before that, she asked to go to the China village. She wanted her Chinas, Edgar. Do you know how long it's been? I did, actually, and it was good to hear him excited on her behalf. She started to fade after I got her there, though. She looked around and asked me where Percy was. She said she wanted Percy, that Percy needed to go in the cookie tin. I looked at my painting, at my ship. It was mine now, all right. My Percy. I licked my lips, which suddenly felt leathery, the way they always had when I first woke up after the accident, when some of the time I couldn't remember who I was. Do you know what's queer? Remembering forgetting. It's like looking into a hall of mirrors. Which one is Percy? Damned if I know. When she wants me to throw the cookie tin in the goldfish pond, she always insists on putting a girl china in it. Usually the shepherdess, with her face chipped off. Did she say anything else? She wanted food, I told you. Tomato soup. And peaches. By then she'd stopped looking at the chinas, and she was getting confused again. Had she gotten confused because Percy wasn't there? Or the Percy? Maybe. But if she'd ever had a China boat, I'd never seen it. I thought, not for the first time, that Percy was a funny word. You couldn't trust it. It kept changing. Wireman said, "At one point she told me the table was leaking." "And was it?" There was a brief pause, then he said, not very humorously, "Are we having a little joke at Wireman's expense, mi amigo?" "No, I'm curious. What did she say, exactly?" "Just that, the table is leaking. But her chinas are on a table, as you well know, not a water table." "Calm down, don't lose your good thoughts." "I'm trying not to, but I have to say you seem a little off your conversational game, Edster." "Don't call me Edster, it sounds like a vintage Ford." "You brought her soup, and she was, what, gone again?" "Pretty much, yeah. She'd broken a couple of her china figures on the floor, a horse and a rodeo girl." He sighed. "Did she say it's leaking before or after you brought her the food?" "After, before, what does it matter?" "I don't know," I said. "Which was it?" "Before, I think. Yes, before. Afterward, she'd pretty much lost interest in everything, including chucking the sweet Owen tin into the pond for the umpteenth time. I brought the soup in her favorite mug, but she pushed it away so hard she slopped some on her poor old arm. She didn't even seem to feel it. Edgar, why are you asking these questions? What do you know?" He was pacing around with the cell phone to his ear. I could see him doing it. "Nothing. I'm feeling around in the dark, for Christ's sake." "Yeah? Which arm are you doing it with?" That stopped me for a moment. But we had come too far and shared too much for lies, even when the truth was nuts. "My right one." "All right," he said. "All right, Edgar. I wish I knew what was going on, that's all, because something is." "Maybe something is. How is she now?" "Sleeping. And I'm interrupting you. You're working." "No," I said, and tossed the brush aside. "I think this is done. And I think I'm also done for a while. Just walking and shelling for me between now and the show. Noble aspirations, but I don't think you can do it. not a workaholic like you. I think you're wrong. Okay, I'm wrong. Won't be the first time. Are you going to come down and visit with us tomorrow? I want you to see it if she lights up again. Count on it. And maybe we could hit a few tennis balls. Fine by me. Wireman, there's one other thing. Did Elizabeth ever paint? He laughed. Who knows? I asked her once, and she said she could hardly draw stick figures. She said her interest in the arts wasn't much different from the interest some wealthy alumni have in football and basketball. She joked about it, said, if you can't be an athlete, be an athletic supporter. Exactly. How'd you know? It's an old one, I said. See you tomorrow. I hung up and stood where I was, watching the long light of evening fire up a gulf sunset I had no urge to paint. They were the same words she'd used with Gene Hadlock, and I had no doubt that if I asked others, I'd hear the same anecdote once or twice or a dozen times. She said, I can't even draw stick figures. She said, if you can't be an athlete, be an athletic supporter. And why? Because an honest woman may occasionally goof the truth. But a good liar never varies her story. I hadn't asked him about the red picnic basket, but I told myself that was all right. If it was in the attic of El Palacio, it would still be there the next day, and the day after that. I told myself there was time. Of course, that's what we always tell ourselves, isn't it? We can't imagine time running out, and God punishes us for what we can't imagine. I looked at girl in ship number 8 with something approaching distaste and threw the cover sheet over it. I never added the red picnic hamper to the bowsprit. I never put a brush to that particular painting again, the final mad descendant of my first sketch in big pink, the one I'd named Hello. Number 8 may have been the best thing I ever did, but in a strange way, I almost forgot it. Until the show, that was. After that, I could never forget it. 6. The picnic basket. That damned red picnic basket full of her drawings. How that haunts me. Even now, 4 years later, I find myself playing the what-if game, wondering how much would have changed if I'd pushed everything else aside and gone hunting for it. It was found by Jack Cantori, but by then it was too late. And maybe, I can't say for sure, it wouldn't have changed anything, because some force was at work, both on Duma Key and inside Edgar Fremantle. Can I say that force brought me there? No. Can I say it didn't? No, I can't say that either. But by the time March became April, it had begun to gain strength and ever so stealthily extend its reach. That basket. Elizabeth's damned picnic basket. It was red. 7. Wireman's hope that Elizabeth was coming around began to seem unjustified. She remained a muttering lump in her wheelchair, every now and then stirring enough to cry out for a cigarette in the cracked voice of an aging parrot. He hired Anne-Marie Whistler away from Bay Area private nursing to come in and help him 4 days a week. The extra help might have eased Wireman's workload, but it did little to comfort him. He was heartsore. But that was something I only glimpsed from the corner of my eye as April rolled in, sunny and hot, because, speaking of hot, there I was. Once Mary Iyer's interview was published, I became a local celebrity. Why not? Artist was good, especially in the Sarasota area. Artist who used to build banks and then turned his back on Mammon was better. One-armed artist of blazing talent was the absolute golden motherfucker. Dario and Jimmy scheduled a number of follow-up interviews, including one with Channel 6. I emerged from their Sarasota studio with a blinding headache and a complimentary Channel 6 Suncoast Weather Watcher bumper sticker, which I ended up plastering on one of the Mean Dog's sawhorses. Don't ask me why. I also took over the Florida end of the travel and hospitality arrangements. Wireman was by then too busy trying to get Elizabeth to ingest anything but cigarette smoke. I found myself consulting with Pam every 2 or 3 days about the guest list from Minnesota and travel arrangements from other parts of the country. Ilsa called twice, I thought she was making an effort to sound cheerful, but I could have been wrong. My attempts to find out how her love life was progressing were kindly but firmly blocked. Melinda called, to ask for my hat size, of all things. When I asked why, she wouldn't tell. 15 minutes after she hung up, I realized she and her French ami were really buying me a fucking beret. I burst out laughing. An AP reporter from Tampa came to Sarasota. He wanted to come to Duma, but I didn't like the idea of a reporter tramping around in big pink, listening to what I now thought of as my shells. He interviewed me at Skodo instead, while a photographer took pictures of 3 carefully selected paintings, Roses Grow from Shells, Sunset with Sephora, and Duma Road. I was wearing a Casey Key Fish House t-shirt, and a photo of me, baseball cap on backwards and one short sleeve empty, except for a nub of stump, ran nationwide. After that, my telephone rang off the hook. Angel Slobotnik called and talked for 20 minutes. At one point, he said he always knew I had it in me. "What?" I asked. His reply was, "Bullshit, boss." And we laughed like maniacs. Kathy Green called. I heard all about her new boyfriend, not so good, and her new self-help program, wonderful. I told her about how Cayman had showed up at the lecture and saved my ass. By the end of the call, she was crying and saying she'd never had such a gutty, come-from-behind patient. Then she said when she saw me, she was going to tell me to drop and give her 50 sit-ups. That sounded like the old Kathy. To top it all off, Todd Jameson, the doctor who had probably saved me from a decade or two as a human rutabaga, sent me a bottle of champagne with a card reading, "Cannot wait to see your work." If Weirman had bet me on whether or not I'd get bored and pick up a brush again before the show, he would have lost. When I wasn't getting ready for my big moment, I was walking, reading, or sleeping. I mentioned this to him on one of the rare afternoons when we were together at the end of El Palacio's boardwalk, drinking green tea under the striped umbrella. This was less than a week before the show. "I'm glad," he said simply. "You needed to rest." "What about you, Wireman? How are you doing?"
"Not great, but I will survive. Gloria Gaynor, 1978. It's sadness, mostly."
He sighed.
"I'm going to lose her. I kidded myself that maybe she was coming back, but I'm going to lose her. It's not like Julia and Esmeralda, thank God, but it still weighs on me.
I'm sorry." I laid my hand over his. "For her and for you."
"Thanks."
He looked out at the waves.
"Sometimes I think she won't die at all."
"No?"
"No, I think the walrus and the carpenter will come for her instead. That they'll just lead her away like they did those trusting oysters. Lead her away down the beach. Do you remember what the walrus says?"
I shook my head.
"It seems a shame to play them such a trick, after we've brought them out so far, and made them trot so quick."
He swiped an arm across his face.
"Look at me, muchacho, crying just like the walrus. Ain't I stupid?"
"No," I said.
"I hate to face the idea that this time she's gone for good, that the best part of her went off down the beach with a walrus and a carpenter, and there's nothing left but a fat old piece of suet that hasn't quite forgotten how to breathe yet."
I said nothing. He wiped his eyes again with his forearm and drew in a long, watery breath. Then he said,
"I looked into the story of John Eastlake and how his daughters were drowned and what happened after. Do you remember asking me to do that?"
I did, but it seemed long ago and unimportant. What I think now is that something wanted it to seem that way to me.
I went surfing around on the internet and came up with a good deal from the local newspapers and a couple of memoirs that are available for download. One of them, I shit you not, muchacho, is called Boat Trips and Beeswax, A Girlhood in Nokomis by Stephanie Wider Gravel Miller.
Sounds like quite a trip down memory lane.
It was. She talks about the happy darkies picking oranges and singing simple songs of praise in their mellifluous voices.
I guess that was before Jay-Z.
Got that right. Even better, I talked to Chris Shannington over on Casey Key. You've almost certainly seen him. colorful old geezer who walks every place with his gnarled briarwood cane, almost as tall as he is, and a big straw hat on his head. His father, Ellis Shannington, was John Eastlake's gardener. According to Chris, it was Ellis who took Maria and Hannah, Elizabeth's two older sisters, back to the Braden School 10 days or so after the drowning. He said, "Those children were heartbroken for the Babians." Wireman's imitation of the old man's southern accent was eerily good, and I found myself for some reason thinking of the walrus and the carpenter again, walking up the beach with the little oysters. The only part of the poem I could remember clearly was the carpenter telling them they'd had a pleasant run, but of course the oysters couldn't answer, for they'd been eaten, every one. "Do you want to hear this now?" Wireman asked. "Have you got time to tell me now?"
"Sure.
Anne-Marie's got the duty until 7, although as a matter of practical fact, we share it most days. Why don't we walk up to the house? I've got a file. There isn't much in it, but there's at least one picture that's worth looking at." Chris Shannington had it in a box of his father's things. I walked up to the Casey Key Public Library with him and copied it. He paused. "It's a picture of Heron's Roost."
"As it was back then, you mean?"
We'd started to stroll back up the boardwalk, but Wireman stopped.
"No, amigo, you misunderstand. I'm talking about the original Heron's Roost. El Palacio is the second roost, built almost 25 years after the little girls drowned. By then, John Eastlake's 10 or 20 million had grown to 150 million or so. War is good business. Invest your son."
"Vietnam protest movement 1969, I said. "Often seen in tandem with a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle."
"Good, amigo," Wireman said.
He waved a hand toward the riotous greenery that began just south of us. "The first Heron's Roost was out there, back when the world was young and flappers said poop-oopy-doop." I thought of Mary Eyer, not just tiddly or squiffy, but downright drunk, saying, "Just the one house, sitting up there and looking like something you'd see on the Gracious Homes tour in Charleston or Mobile." "What happened to it?" I asked.
"So far as I know, nothing but time and decay," he said.
"When John Eastlake gave up on recovering the bodies of his twins, he gave up on Duma Key, too. He paid off most of the help, packed his traps, took the 3 daughters who remained to him, got in his Rolls Royce, he really had one, and drove away. A novel F. Scott Fitzgerald never wrote. That's what Chris Shannington said. Told me Eastlake was never at peace until Elizabeth brought him back here."
"Do you think that's something Shannington actually knows, or just a story he's gotten used to hearing himself tell?"
"Quién sabe," Wireman said. He stopped again and waved toward the southern end of Duma Key. "No overgrowth back then. You could see the original house from the mainland, and vice versa. And so far as I know, amigo, the house is still there. Whatever's left of it, sitting and rotting." He reached the kitchen door and looked at me, unsmiling.
"That would be something to paint, wouldn't it? A ghost ship on dry land."
"Maybe," I said. "Maybe it would." 8. He took me into the library with the suit of armor in the corner and the museum-quality weapons on the wall. There on the table next to the telephone was a folder marked John Eastlake, Heron's Roost, 1. He opened it and removed a photograph showing a house that bore an unmistakable similarity to the one we were in. The similarity, say, of first cousins. Yet there was one basic difference between the two. And the similarities, the same basic footprint for both houses, I thought, and the same roof of bright orange Spanish tile, only underlined it. The current Palacio, hid from the world behind a high wall broken by only a single gate. There wasn't even a tradesman's entrance. It had a beautiful interior courtyard which few people other than Wireman, Anne-Marie, and the twice-weekly gardener ever saw. It was like the body of a beautiful woman hidden under a shapeless piece of clothing. The first Heron's Roost was very different. Like Elizabeth's mansion in Chinatown, it featured 6 pillars and a broad, welcoming veranda. It had a wide drive sweeping boldly up to it, splitting what looked like 2 acres of lawn. Not a gravel drive, either, as Mary Eyer had told me, but rosy, crushed shells. The original had invited the world in. Its successor, El Palacio,
told the world to stay the hell out. Ilsa had seen that at once, and so had I. But that day we had been looking from the road. Since then my view had changed, and with good reason. I had gotten used to seeing it from the beach, to coming upon it from its unarmored side. The first heron's roost had also been higher, 3 stories in front and 4 in back, so, if it really did stand on a rise, as Mary had said, people on the top floor would have had a breathtaking 360-degree view of the Gulf, the mainland, Casey Key, and Don Pedro Island. Not bad. But the lawn looked strangely ragged, unkempt. And there were holes in the line of ornamental palms dancing like hula girls on either side of the house. I looked closer and saw that some of the upper windows had been boarded up. The roof line had a strangely unbalanced look, too. It took a second to realize why. There was a chimney at the east end. There should have been another at the west end, but there wasn't. "Was this taken after they left?" I asked. He shook his head. According to Shannington, it was snapped in March of 1927, before the little girls drowned, when everyone was still happy and well. That isn't dilapidation, you see, it's storm damage from an Alice. Which is what? Hurricane season officially starts June 15th down here and lasts about 5 months. Out-of-season storms, with torrential rains and high winds. As far as the old-timers are concerned, they're all Alice. As in Hurricane Alice. It's kind of a joke.
You're making that up.
Nope. Esther, the big one in 26, missed Duma completely. But the Alice in March of 27 hit it pretty much dead on. Then it blew inland and drowned in the glades. It did the damage you see in this picture. Not much, really. Blew down some palms, knocked out some glass, tore up the lawn. But in another way, its effects are still being felt, because it seems pretty certain that it was that Alice that led to the drowning deaths of Tessie and Laura. And that led to everything else, including you and me standing here now. Explain. Remember this? He took another photo from his folder, and I certainly did remember it. The big one was on the second floor landing of the main staircase. This was a smaller, sharper copy. It was the Eastlake family, with John Eastlake wearing a black bathing singlet and looking like a Hollywood B-list actor who might have specialized in detective movies and jungle epics. He was holding Elizabeth. One hand cupped her plump little bottom. The other held that harpoon pistol and a face mask with an attached snorkel. Judging just by Elizabeth, I'm going to guess that this might have been taken around 1925, Wireman said. She looks 2 going on 3, and Adriana, he tapped the eldest, looks like she might be 17 going on 34, wouldn't you say? Indeed, 17 and ripe. Even in her it-covers-damn-near-everything bathing suit. She's already got that sulky, pouty, I-want-to-be-somewhere-else look, too, Wireman said. I wonder just how surprised her father was when she up and eloped with one of his plant managers. And I wonder if he wasn't, in his heart of hearts, glad to see her go. He put on his Chris Shannington drawl. Run off to Atlanta with a boy and a tie and an eye shade. Then he quit it. I guess the subject of little dead girls, even ones lost 80 years ago, was still a tender one with him. She and her new hubby came back, but by then it was just a hunt for the bodies. I tapped the grim-faced black nanny. Who was this? Melda or Tilda or maybe even, God save us, Hecuba, according to Chris Shannington. His father knew, but Chris no longer remembers. Nice bracelets. He glanced at them without much interest. If you say so. Maybe John Eastlake was sleeping with her, I said. Maybe the bracelets were a little present. Quien sabe? Rich widower? Young woman? Been known to happen. I tapped the picnic basket, which the young black woman was holding with both hands, her arms bunched as though it was heavy. Heavier than just a few sandwiches could account for, you'd think. But maybe there was a whole chicken in there, and maybe a few bottles of beer for old Massa as well, a little reward after he'd finished his day's dives. What color would you say that hamper is? Dark brown, or is it red? Wireman gave me a strange look.
In a black-and-white photograph, it's hard to tell. Tell me how the storm led to the deaths of the little girls. He opened the folder again and handed me an old news story with an accompanying photograph. This is from the Venice Gondolier, March 28, 1927. I got the original info on the net. Jack Cantori called the paper, got someone to make a copy and shoot me a fax. Jack's terrific, by the way. No argument there, I said. I studied the photo. Who are these girls? No, don't tell me. The one on the left's Maria. Hannah's on his right. A plus. Hannah's the one with breasts. She was 14 in 27. We studied the fax sheet in silence for a few moments. Email would have been better. The fax had annoying dark vertical lines running through it, blurring some of the print. But the headline was clear enough. Storm proves treasure hunting boon to amateur diver. And the picture was clear enough, too. Eastlake's hairline had receded a little. As if to compensate, his narrow bandleader's mustache was now closer to a walrus. And although he was still wearing the same black bathing singlet, it was now under severe stress, and actually popped under one arm, I thought. Although the picture's resolution wasn't quite good enough to be certain. It appeared Dad Eastlake had packed on some pork between 1925 and 1927. The B-movie actor would have trouble getting roles if he didn't start skipping desserts and doing more work in the gym. The girls flanking him weren't as slow-eyed sexy as their big sister. You looked at Adriana and thought about hot afternoons in a haymow. You looked at these two and wondered if they were getting their schoolwork done. But they were pretty in a not-quite-there-yet way, and their excitement shone out in the picture. Sure it did. Because spread before them on the sand was treasure. I can't make it all out, and the damn caption's blurry, I complained. There's a magnifying glass in the desk, but let me save you a headache. Wireman picked up a pen and pointed with the tip. That's a medicine bottle, and that there is a musket ball, or so Eastlake claims in the story. Maria's got her hand on what appears to be a boot, or the remains of one. Next to the boot, a pair of spectacles, I said, and a necklace chain? The story claims it's a bracelet. I don't know. All I could swear to is a metal loop of some kind, overgrown with crud. But the older girl's definitely holding out an earring. I scanned the story. In addition to the stuff on view, Eastlake had found various eating utensils. Four cups, he claimed, were Italianate, a trivet, a box of gears, whatever that might mean, and nails without number. He'd also found half a China man. Not a Chinaman, a China man. It wasn't pictured, at least not that I could see. The story said Eastlake had been diving on the eroded reefs west of Duma Key for 15 years, sometimes to fish, often just to relax. He said he had found all sorts of litter, but nothing of interest. He said that the Alice, he called it that, had generated some remarkably big waves, and they must have shifted the sand inside the reef just enough to reveal what he called a dumping field. He doesn't call it a wreck, I said. It wasn't, Wireman said. There was no boat. He didn't find one, and neither did the dozens of people who helped him try to recover the bodies of his little girls. Only detritus. They would have found a wreck if there was a wreck to find. The water on the southwest end of the key is no more than 25 feet deep, all the way out to what remains of Kitt Reef, and it's pretty clear now. Back then it was like turquoise glass. Any theories about how it came to be there? Sure. The best is that some boat close to foundering came blowing in 100, 200, 300 years before, shedding shit as it came. Or maybe the crew was tossing stuff overboard to stay afloat. They made repairs after the storm was over and went on their way. It would explain why there was a swath of detritus for Eastlake to find, and also why none of it was particularly valuable. Treasure would have stayed with the ship. And the reef wouldn't have ripped the keel out of a boat that got blown in here back in the 1700s or the 1600s? Wireman shrugged. Chris Shannington says no one knows what the geography of Kitt Reef might have been 150 years ago. I looked at the spread-out loot. The smiling middle daughters, the smiling daddy, who was soon going to have to buy himself a new bathing costume,
and I suddenly decided he hadn't been sleeping with the nanny, no. Even a mistress would have told him he couldn't have a newspaper photo of himself taken in that old thing. She would have found a tactful reason. But the real one was right in front of me. After all these years, even with less than perfect vision in my right eye, I could see it. He was too fat. Only he didn't see it. And his daughters didn't see it either. Loving eyes did not see. Too fat. Something there, wasn't there? Some A that practically demanded a B. I'm surprised he talked about what he found at all, I said. If you happened on stuff like this today and then blabbed to Channel 6, half of Florida would show up in their little putt-putts hunting for doubloons and pieces of eight with metal detectors. Ah, but this was another Florida, Wireman said, and I remembered Mary Iyer using the same phrase. John Eastlake was a rich man, and Duma Key was his private preserve. Besides, there were no doubloons, no pieces of eight. Just moderately interesting junk, uncovered by a freak storm. For weeks he went down and dived where that debris was scattered on the floor of the Gulf. And it was close in. According to Shannington, at low tide you could practically wade to it. And sure, he was probably keeping an eye out for valuables. He was a rich man, but I don't think that vaccinates a man against the treasure bug. No, I said. I'm sure it doesn't. The nanny would have gone with him on his treasure-hunting expeditions. The three still-at-home girls, too. The twins and Elizabeth. Maria and Hannah were back at their boarding school in Bradenton, and Big Sis had run off to Atlanta. Eastlake and his little ones probably had picnics down there. How often? I began to see where this was going. Often. Maybe every day while the debris field was at its richest. They wore a path from the house to what was called Shade Beach. It was half a mile, if that. A path two adventurous little girls could follow on their own. And one day did, to everyone's sorrow. He swept the pictures back into the folder. There's a story here, muchacho, and I suppose it's marginally more interesting than a little girl swallowing a marble, but a tragedy is a tragedy. And at the bottom, all tragedies are stupid. Give me a choice and I'll take A Midsummer Night's Dream over Hamlet any time. Any fool with steady hands and a working set of lungs can build up a house of cards and then blow it down, but it takes a genius to make people laugh. He brooded a moment. What probably happened is that one day in April of 1927, when Tessie and Laura were supposed to be napping, they decided to get up, sneak down the path, and go hunting for treasure at Shade Beach. Probably they meant to do no more than wade in as far as their knees, which is all they were permitted to do. One of the stories quotes John Eastlake as saying that, and Adriana backed him up. The married daughter who came back. Right. She and her new husband returned a day or two before the search for the bodies was officially called off. That's according to Shannington. Anyway, one of the little girls maybe saw something gleaming a little farther out, started to flounder, then her sister tried to save her. Yes, I could see it. Only I saw Lynn and Ilsa, as they had been when they were small. Not twins, but for 3 or 4 golden years, nearly inseparable. Wireman nodded. And then the rip took them both. Had to have been that way, amigo. That's why the bodies weren't found. Off they went, hi-ho, for the Caldo Largo. I opened my mouth to ask him what he meant by the rip, and then remembered a painting by Winslow Homer, romantic but of undeniable power, Undertow. The intercom on the wall beeped, startling us both. Wireman struck the folder with his arm as he turned around, knocking photocopies and faxes everywhere. "Mr. Wireman!" It was Anne-Marie Whistler. "Mr. Wireman, are you there?" "I'm here," Wireman said. "Mr. Wireman!" She sounded agitated. Then, as if to herself, "Jesus, where are you?" "The fucking button," he muttered, and went to the wall unit, not quite running. He pushed the button. "I'm here. What's wrong? What's happened? Did she fall?" "No," Anne-Marie cried. "She's awake, awake and aware. She's asking for you. Can you come?" "Right away," he said, and turned to me grinning. "You hear that, Edgar? Come on." He paused. "What are you looking at?" "These," I said, and held out the two pictures of Eastlake in his bathing dress. The one where he was surrounded by all his daughters, and the one taken 2 years later where he was flanked by just Maria and Hannah.
"Never mind him now, didn't you hear? Miss Eastlake is back."
He booked for the door. I dropped his folder on the library table and followed him. I had made the connection, but only because I'd spent the last few months cultivating the art of seeing, cultivating it strenuously. "Wireman," I called. He'd gone the length of the dog trot and was halfway up the staircase. I was limping as fast as I could, and he was still pulling away. He waited for me, not very patiently. "Who told him the debris field was there?"
"Eastlake? I assume he stumbled on it while pursuing his diving hobby."
"I don't think so. He hadn't been in that bathing suit for a long time. Diving and snorkeling may have been his hobby in the early 20s, but I think that around 1925, eating dinner became his chief diversion. So who told him?" Anne-Marie came out of a door near the end of the hall. There was a goofy, unbelieving grin on her face that made her look half her 40 years.
"Come on," she said, "this is wonderful."
"Is she?"
"She is," came Elizabeth's cracked but unmistakable voice.
"Come in here, Wireman, and let me see your face while I still know it." 9. I lingered in the hall with Anne-Marie, not sure what to do, looking at the knick-knacks and the big old Frederick Remington at the far end, Indians on ponies. Then Wireman called for me. His voice was impatient and rough with tears. The room was dim. The shades had all been drawn. Air conditioning whispered through a vent somewhere above us. There was a table next to her bed with a lamp on it. The shade was green glass. The bed was the hospital kind, and cranked up so she could almost sit. The lamp put her in a soft spotlight, with her hair loose on the shoulders of a pink dressing gown. Wireman sat beside her, holding her hands. Above her bed was the only painting in the room, a fine print of Edward Hopper's 11 a.m., an archetype of loneliness, waiting patiently at the window for some change, any change. Somewhere a clock was ticking. She looked at me and smiled. I saw three things in her face. They hit me one after the other like stones, each one heavier than the last. The first was how much weight she lost. The second was that she looked horribly tired. The third was that she hadn't long to live. "Edward," she said.
"No,"
I began, but when she raised one hand, the flesh hanging down in a snow-white bag above her elbow, I stilled at once, because here was a fourth thing to see, and it hit hardest of all. Not a stone, but a boulder. I was looking at myself. This was what people had seen in the aftermath of my accident, when I was trying to sweep together the poor, scattered bits of my memory. All that treasure that looked like trash when it was spread out in such ugly, naked fashion. I thought of how I had forgotten my doll's name, and I knew what was coming next. "I can do this," she said.
"I know you can," I said.
"You brought Wireman back from the hospital," she said.
"Yes.
I was so afraid they'd keep him, and I would be alone." I didn't reply to this.
"Are you Edmund?"
she asked timidly.
"Miss Eastlake, don't tax yourself,"
Wireman said gently.
"This is..."
"Hush, Wireman," I said. "She can do this."
"You paint," she said.
"Yes."
"Have you painted the ship yet?"
A curious thing happened to my stomach. It didn't sink so much as it seemed to disappear and leave a void between my heart and the rest of my guts. My knees tried to buckle. The steel in my hip went hot. The back of my neck went cold, and warm, prickling fire ran up the arm that wasn't there.
"Yes," I said, again and again and again. "You're Edgar," she said.
"Yes, Elizabeth, I'm Edgar. Good for you, honey." She smiled. I guess no one had called her honey in a long time.
"My mind is like a tablecloth with a great big hole burned into it."
She turned to Wireman.
"Muy divertido, see?"
"You need to rest," he said. "In fact, you need to dormir como un tronco." She smiled faintly.
"Like a log, yes,"
Then I think when I wake up, I'll still be here. For a little while. She lifted his hands to her face and kissed them. I love you, Wyman.
I love you too, Miss Eastlake, he said.
Good for him.
Edgar? Is it Edgar?
What do you think, Elizabeth?
Yes, of course it is. You're to have a show. Is that how we left things before my last?
She drooped her eyelids as if to mime sleep. Yes, at the Scotto Gallery. You really need to rest.
Is it soon, your show?
In less than a week.
Your paintings, the ship paintings, are they on the mainland, at the gallery?
Wireman and I exchanged a look. He shrugged.
Yes, I said.
Good. She smiled. I'll rest then. Everything else can wait. Until after you have your show.
Your moment in the sun. Are you selling them? The ship pictures?
Wireman and I exchanged another look, and the message in his eyes was very clear. Don't upset her. They're marked NFS, Elizabeth. That means...
I know what it means, Edgar. I didn't fall out of an orange tree yesterday.
Inside their deep pockets of wrinkles, caught in a face that was receding toward death, her eyes flashed.
Sell them. However many there are, you must sell them. And however hard it is for you, break them up. Send them to the four winds. Do you understand me?
Yes.
Will you do it?
I didn't know if I would or not, but I recognized her signs of growing agitation from my own not-so-distant past. Yes. At that point, I would have promised her to jump to the moon in 7-league boots, if it would have eased her mind.
Even then, they may not be safe,
she mused in an almost horrified voice. Stop now, I said, and patted her hand. Stop thinking about this.
All right, we'll talk more after your show. The three of us. I'll be stronger, clearer, and you, Edgar, will be able to pay attention. Do you have daughters? I seem to remember that you do.
Yes, and they're staying on the mainland with their mother at the Ritz. That's already arranged. She smiled, but the corners drooped almost at once. It was as if her mouth were melting.
Crank me down, Wyman. I've been in the swamp 40 days and 40 nights. So it feels, and I'm tired.
He cranked her down, and Anne-Marie came in with something in a glass on a tray. No chance Elizabeth was going to drink any of it. She had already corked off. Over her head, the loneliest girl in the world sat in a chair and looked out the window forever, face hidden by the fall of her hair, naked but for a pair of shoes. 10. For me, sleep was long in coming that night. It was after midnight before I finally slipped away. The tide had withdrawn, and the whispered conversation under the house had ceased. That didn't stop the whispered voices in my head, however. Another Florida, Mary Eyre whispered. That was another Florida. Sell them. However many there are, you must sell them. That was Elizabeth, of course. The grown Elizabeth. I heard another version of her, however. And because I had to make this voice up, what I heard was Ilse's voice, as it had been as a child.
There's treasure, Daddy, this voice said.
You can get it if you put on your mask and snorkel. I can show you where to look. I drew a picture. 11. I was up with the dawn. I thought I could go to sleep again, but not until I took one of the few OxyContin pills I still had put aside. And until I made a telephone call. I took the pill, then dialed the Scotto and got the answering machine. There wouldn't be a living person in the gallery for hours yet. Artistic types aren't morning people. I pushed 11 for Dario Nannuzzi's extension, and after the beep I said, Dario, it's Edgar. I've changed my mind about the Girl and Ship series. I want to sell them after all, okay? The only caveat is that they should all go to different people, if possible. Thanks. I hung up and went back to bed. Lay there for 15 minutes watching the overhead fan turn lazily and listening to the shells whisper beneath me. The pill was working, but I wasn't drifting off. And I knew why. I knew exactly why. I got up again, hit redial, listened to the recorded message, then punched in Dario's extension one more time. His recorded voice invited me to leave a message at the beep. "Except for number 8, I said. "That one is still NFS." And why was it NFS? Not because it was genius, although I think it was. Not even because when I looked at it, it was, for me, like listening to the darkest part of my heart telling its tale. It was because I felt that something had let me live just to paint it, and that to sell it would be to deny my own life and all the pain I had undergone to reclaim it. "Yeah, that." "That one's mine, Dario," I said. Then I went back to bed, and that time I slept. How to Draw a Picture. 7. Remember that seeing is believing, puts the cart before the horse. Art is the concrete artifact of faith and expectation, the realization of a world that would otherwise be little more than a veil of pointless consciousness stretched over a gulf of mystery. And besides, if you don't believe what you see, who will believe your art? The trouble after the treasure all had to do with belief. Elizabeth was fiercely talented, but she was only a child. And with children, faith is a given. It's part of the standard equipment. Nor are children, even the talented ones, especially the talented ones, in full possession of their faculties. Their reason still sleeps, and the sleep of reason breeds monsters. Here's a picture I never painted. Identical twins in identical jumpers, except one is red, with an L on the front, and the other is blue, with a T. The girls are holding hands as they run along the path that leads to Shade Beach. They call it that because for most of the day, it's in the shadow of Hag's Rock. There are tear tracks on their pale, round faces, but they will soon be gone because by now they are too terrorized to cry. If you can believe this, you can see the rest. A giant crow flies slowly past them, upside down, its wings outstretched. It speaks to them in their daddy's voice. Lolo falls and cuts her knees on the shells. Tessie pulls her to her feet. They run on. It isn't the upside-down talking crow they're afraid of, nor the way the sky sometimes lenses from blue to a sunset red before going back to blue. It is the thing behind them, the big boy. Even with its fangs, it still looks a little like one of the funny frogs Libet used to draw. But this one is ever so much bigger and real enough to cast a shadow, real enough to stink and shake the ground each time it jumps. They have been frightened by all sorts of things since Daddy found the treasure, and Libet says they dasn't come out of their room at night, or even look out of their windows, but this is day, and the thing behind them is too real not to be believed, and it is gaining. The next time it's Tessie who falls and Lolo who pulls her up, casting a terrified glance behind her at the thing chasing them. It's surrounded by dancing bugs it sometimes licks out of the air. Lolo can see Tessie in one bulging, stupid eye. She herself is in the other. They burst onto the beach, gasping and out of breath, and now there's nowhere to go but the water. Except maybe there is because the boat is back again, the one they have seen more and more frequently in the last few weeks. Libet says the boat isn't what it seems, but now it's a floating, white dream of safety, and besides, there is no choice. The big boy is almost at their heels. It came out of the swimming pool just after they finished playing Addie's wedding in Rampopo, the baby house on the side lawn. Today Lolo got to play Addie. Sometimes Libet can make these awful things go away by scribbling on her pad, but now Libet is sleeping. She has had a great many troubled nights lately. The big boy leaps off the path and onto the beach, spraying sand all around. Its bulging eyes stare. Its fragile white belly so full of noisome guts bulges. Its throat throbs. The two girls, standing with their hands linked and their feet in the running boil of what Daddy calls the little surf, look at each other. Then they look at the ship, swinging at anchor with its sails furled and shining. It looks even closer. as if it has moved in to rescue them. Lolo says we have to. Tessie says, but I can't swim. You can dog paddle. The big boy leaps. They can hear its guts slosh when it lands. They sound like wet garbage in a barrel of water. The blue fades from the sky, and then the sky bleeds red. Then slowly it changes back again. It's been that kind of day. And haven't they known this kind of day was coming? Haven't they seen it in Libet's haunted eyes? Nan Melda knows. Even Daddy knows. And he's not here all the time. Today he's in Tampa. And when they look at the greenish-white horror that's almost upon them, they know that Tampa might as well be the far side of the moon. They are on their own. Tessie grips Lolo's shoulder with cold fingers. What about the rip? But Lolo shakes her head. The rip is good. The rip will take us to the boat. There's no more time to talk. The frog thing is getting ready to leap again, and they understand that, while it cannot be real, somehow it is. It can kill them. Better to chance the water. They turn, still holding hands, and throw themselves into the caldo. They fix their eyes on the slim white swallow, swinging at anchor close to them. Surely they will be hauled aboard, and someone will use the ship to shore to call the roost. Netted us a pair of mermaids, they'll say. You know anyone who wants them? The rip parts their hands. It is ruthless, and Lolo actually drowns first because she fights harder. Tessie hears her cry out twice, first for help, then giving up her sister's name. Meanwhile, a vagary of the rip is sweeping Tessie straight for the ship and holding her up at the same time. For a few magical moments, it's as though she's on a surfboard, and her weak dog paddle seems to be propelling her like an outboard motor. Then, just before a colder current reaches up and coils around her ankles, she sees the ship change into... Here's a picture I did paint, not once, but again and again and again. The whiteness of the hull doesn't exactly disappear. It is sucked inward like blood fleeing the cheek of a terrified man. The ropes fray. The bright work dulls. The glass in the windows of the aft cabin bursts outward. A junk heap clutter appears on the decking, rolling into existence from fore to aft. Except it was there all along. Tessie just didn't see it. Now she sees. Now she believes. A creature comes from below decks. It creeps to the railing, where it stares down at the girl. It is a slumped thing in a hooded red robe. Hair that might not be hair at all flutters dankly around a melted face. Yellow hands grip splintered punky wood, then one lifts slowly and waves to the girl, who will soon be gone. It says, "Come to me, child." And, drowning, Tessie Eastlake thinks, "It's a woman." She sinks. And does she feel still warm hands, those of her freshly dead sister gripping her calves and pulling her down? Yes, of course. Of course she does. Believing is also feeling. Any artist will tell you so. 13. The Show. 1. Someday, if your life is long, and your thinking machinery stays in gear, you'll live to remember the last good thing that ever happened to you. That's not pessimism talking, just logic. I hope I haven't run out of good things yet. There would be no purpose in living if I believed I had. But it's been a long time between. I remember the last one, clearly. It happened a little over 4 years ago, on the evening of April 15th, at the Scotto Gallery. It was between 7:45 and 8 o'clock, and the shadows on Palm Avenue were beginning to take on the first faint tinges of blue. I know the time because I kept checking my watch. The Scotto was already packed, to the legal limit and probably a little beyond, but my family hadn't arrived. I had seen Pam and Illy earlier in the day, and Wireman had assured me that Melinda's flight was on time. But so far that evening, there hadn't been a sign of them, or a call. In the alcove to my left, where both the bar and 8 of the Sunset With pictures had drawn a crowd, a trio from the local music conservatory was tinkling through a funereal version of My Funny Valentine. Mary Eyer, holding a glass of champagne but sober so far, was expatiating on something artistic to an attentive little crowd. To the right was a bigger room featuring a buffet. On one wall in there was Roses Grow from Shells and the painting called I See the Moon. On another, three views of Duma Road. I'd observed several people taking photographs of these with their camera phones, although a sign on a tripod just inside the door announced that all photography was verboten. I mentioned this to Jimmy Yoshida in passing, and he nodded, seeming not angry or even irritated, but rather bemused. There are a great many people here I either don't associate with the art scene or don't recognize at all, he said. The size of this crowd is outside my experience. Is that a bad thing? God, no. But after years of fighting to keep our corporate heads above water, it feels strange to be carried along this way. The Skoto Center Gallery was large, which was a good thing that night. In spite of the food, drink, and music in the smaller rooms, the center seemed to be where most of the visitors eventually gravitated. The Girl and Ship series had been mounted there on almost invisible cords, directly down the center of the room. Wireman Looks West was on the wall at the far end. That one and Girl and Ship Number 8 were the only paintings in the show which I had stickered NFS, Wireman because the painting was his, and Number 8 because I simply couldn't sell it. "We keeping you up, boss?" Angel Slobotnik said from my left, as oblivious to his wife's elbow as ever. "No," I said. "I was never more awake in my life. I just—" A man in a suit that had to have cost $2,000 stuck out his hand. "Henry Vestic, Mr. Fremantle, First Sarasota Bank and Trust, private accounts. These are just marvelous. I'm stunned. I am amazed." "Thank you," I said, thinking he'd left out, "You must not stop." "Very kind." A business card appeared between his fingers. It was like watching a street busker do a magic trick, or would have been if street buskers wore Armani suits. "If there's anything I can do, I've written my phone numbers on the back, home, cell, office." "Very kind," I repeated. I couldn't think of anything else to say, and really, what did Mr. Vestic think I was going to do? Call him at home and thank him again? Ask him for a loan and offer him a painting as collateral? "May I bring my wife over later and introduce her?" he asked, and I saw a look in his eyes. It wasn't exactly like the look that had been in Wireman's when he realized that I'd put the blocks to Candy Brown, but it was close, as if Vestic were a little afraid of me. "Of course," I said, and he slipped away. "You used to build banks for guys like that and then have to fight them when they didn't want to pay the overage," Angel said. He was in a blue off-the-rack suit and looked on the verge of bursting out of it in 9 different directions, like the Incredible Hulk. "Back then he would have thought you were just some moke trying to mess up his day. Now he looks at you like you could shit gold belt buckles." "Angel, you stop," Helen Slobotnik cried, simultaneously throwing another elbow and grabbing for her glass of champagne. He held it serenely out of her reach. "Tell her it's the truth, boss." "I think it sort of is," I said. And it wasn't only the banker I was getting that look from. The women, geez. When my eyes met theirs, I caught a softening, a speculation, as if they were wondering how I might hold them with only one arm. That was probably crazy, but I was grabbed from behind, almost yanked off my feet. My own glass of champagne would have spilled, but Angel snatched it deftly. I turned, and there was Kathy Green smiling at me. She had left the rehab Gestapo far behind, at least for tonight. She was wearing a short, shimmery green dress that clung to every well-maintained inch of her, and in her heels she stood almost to my forehead. Standing beside her, towering over her, was Cayman. His enormous eyes swam benevolently behind his horn-rimmed glasses. "Jesus, Kathy," I cried. "What would you have done if you'd knocked me over?"
"Made you give me 50. She said, smiling more widely than ever. Her eyes were full of tears. "Told you that on the phone. Look at your tan, you handsome boy."
The tears spilled over and she hugged me. I hugged back, then shook hands with Cayman. His hand swallowed mine whole.
"Your plane is the way for men my size to fly," he said, and people turned in his direction.
He had one of those deep James Earl Jones voices that can make supermarket circulars sound like the Book of Isaiah.
I enjoyed myself to the max, Edgar.
It's not really mine, but thank you, I said. Have either of you...